everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kems.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, this time covering chapters 27 and 28, part 2. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
Before we start, we have a little bit of housekeeping to do. So this episode is going to be released on December 21st. Normally, the next episode would be out on December 28th, but because it's Christmas, we're going to take this week off.
Mm-hmm.
So there won't be an episode next week, but they will resume again on January 4th.
Wonderful. I love Christmas.
Me too.
I'm so excited. It's all the food. And
it's the lights for me. I love the lights.
The lights, the whole atmosphere makes the food taste better. It makes the movies cuter. Makes the drinks better too.
I guess we should jump right into this week's listener question because there's a lot to discuss. Many feelings and opinions here. We promised this a couple episodes ago, so we are going to talk about Murphy.
Oh, I'm excited. Good topic. Ooh, yeah.
I feel like he's turned into some sort of mini Snape. You know, is he good or is he bad?
Mm-hmm.
Before Deathly Hallows was published, were you guys on team Snape's good or team Snape's bad?
I can't remember. I think I always thought that he'd killed Dumbledore on Dumbledore's own orders. Like it was a plan to spare Draco, or there was some purpose to it. So I was pretty sure he was like a double agent still, ultimately on the side of Hogwarts or whatever. But I also always thought that he was an enormous asshole, and still do.
Absolutely.
Real prick.
That's accurate. That's very accurate.
Yeah, that sounds about the same for me too, where it was he's ultimately working for the good side, but he's still such an enormous prick that it's like, ugh.
Do either of you remember Borders Bookstores?
Oh, yeah.
Have them up here.
You remember, Ken?
Oh, yeah.
If you pre-sailed Deathly Hallows with them, you got to pick a sticker. And you could either pick Trust Snape or Snape is a Very Bad Man.
Nice.
I still have my Trust Snape sticker, which I laminated and use as a bookmark now.
Oh.
So I never forget what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cute.
But anyway, the difference here, though, is that I think the answer to that is so much less important than it is in Harry Potter. Whether Murphy remains to be nice, but clearly a bad match for Robin, or we see the, and I quote, mean and aggressive side to him, I don't really think it matters. We know Strike and Robin are going to end up together. So sometimes I find the intensity behind the Murphy opinions to be surprising because I just don't think he matters that much. Murphy is probably the thing I am worried least about, honestly. He's that unimportant in my opinion.
Yeah, I think he's going to be gone by the end of book 8.
Yeah, I do too. We're actually going to read a couple of opposing messages from listeners.
Ooh.
Let's start off with the one that Ken's got and we can explore the Team Murphy as a bad guy first. Does that sound okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love a debate.
I think we're all on the same side though, so it's not really much of a debate.
It's not going to be like, fight, fight.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a message that I got from Michelle and she said, okay, I did a deep dive of anything to do with Ryan Murphy and I'm worried. I think we could possibly see some abusive shit from him. JKR has been very subtle and I think purposely withheld important information about him, but there's a trend here that can't be ignored. Of course, it could be a red herring. She's really good at that. The series is rife with misogyny and various kinds of abuse toward women and girls. Mm-hmm. Seeing Robin navigate a cult was one thing. Being guilted by a gaslighter she's having sex with is another. One she feels guilty about due to her feelings about Strike and with whom she just wants peace. I think JKR has left a lot of subtle and toward the end, not so subtle breadcrumbs.
Okay. Mm. I totally agree with this, with the key word being potentially.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I get confused when people who defend Murphy say that there's nothing wrong with him at all, because we're flat out told by Wardle that he has a history of being mean and aggressive when drunk, which to me means he's capable of both of those things, even if sober.
It's like they say, like, drunk words are sober thoughts.
Yeah. And we're told that he hits on any woman, even if they're married. I just don't know how you can read that and then say there is nothing potentially wrong there.
Yeah, I agree.
I know people will counter with, but that's in the past. He's sober. He's changed. We haven't seen him behave that way. I think that's totally possible, but these are books.
Yeah.
I think the Murphy haters or the Murphy open-minders, as I am thinking of myself, they were completely justified in being at least worried by Wardle's warning.
And I think there's some foreshadowing that we might see the return of Drunk Murphy. Mm. I'm thinking mostly of Pat's line. When she's listening to Charlotte's messages on the phone with Strike, she says, "You can't trust a drinker. Yes. You never know what mm-hmm. they might do when the brakes are off."
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To me, that feels like a little bit of a neon sign flashing, yeah. right? And I think that Murphy's alcoholism has been mentioned so much for a reason. I know he's sober now, but relapses do happen. Right? Yeah. A realistic portrayal of addiction has to include a relapse as a possibility, right?
It does seem like it's very possibly being set up. So yeah, I agree. And it's not like there aren't other things too that we don't really like. We've already said a lot of those issues that we have with him in this book, and it's going to come up when we get to other parts again too. So I don't think there are zero warnings about him in this book, which is why I like him so much less than I did when we had just read Ink Blackheart.
Yeah, same. There were several points in this book where seeing at the very least pink flags.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm super looking forward to dissecting them when we get there. But just to briefly mention, like the scene where they're watching that video of Becca, the I love you right after she's back from the cult,
yeah.
interrogating her about sleeping in the office, the meeting with Wardle and Vanessa being the ones to take the case seriously. Like,
yeah,
I have thoughts about me all too. Of those scenes.
Me so. Too. I also have thoughts about his respect for Robin's work and her career.
Yeah.
The letters. We have lots of thoughts.
So there's another Murphy is a bad guy theory going around that I love, and that it's he's tracking Robin's phone now, like Philip Ormond did to Edie. So a couple of people have said this and sent this into us, saying that that's why Robin has a low phone battery near the end of the book after staying the night with Ryan. And I gotta say, I'm totally on board with this theory. I love it, because there's no other mention of her phone being old or unreliable throughout the book. For it to suddenly happen just after she spent the night with him, it's sus.
If the book picks up right where this one left off and it comes up again and he's like, why do you need a new phone?
Yeah.
We'll be on the lookout for it, depending on
the
time jump. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see you.
This feels a little bit less likely to me, to be honest.
When have I ever cared about likely?
But the setup would be there with Murphy and Ormond, like you said. My counter to this argument would be that her phone messing up is to ramp up the anxiety about her going inside the temple by herself, you know, to confront Becca and Mazu. But yeah, I'll put this down as a potential.
Okay. So like we said, though, we are going to present a counter argument. And we got this comment from Nikki over on Facebook. So she says, I would love opinions on my ongoing inner conversation about Ryan Murphy. I feel like there's a temptation to just call him bad or Matthew 2.0, to go after his alcoholism, his jealousy of Strike, etc. And I know JKR does nothing by accident. If it's there, it's there for a reason. But I really think he's fine. He's human. He's a good guy on balance. He's flawed, as we all are, and he's right to have concerns about Strike. They're in love with each other. He's a police detective. He can't be oblivious. I think it's important that he's a decent guy on balance, because Robin needs to choose Strike for Strike, not as an alternative to something unhealthy. She'd only been with Matthew. She worried in previous books that her feelings for Strike were just because Matthew was an ass. He was dreadful. She needed a decent, healthy, normal relationship. She needs to see that her relationship can be fine, that she can be with a decent guy and have solid sex, and it still not be right because it's not Strike. She needs to know it can be a textbook compatibility, but it's still not enough because it's not Strike.
Oh, I love that.
JKR has been fantastic about making them work on themselves before coming together. No shortcuts or unrealistic rom-com nonsense. They both had to do the work. They don't want to change each other. They are motivated to work on becoming a healthier version of themselves because they're inspired by the other. If we are going to see the relationship we all want, she has to choose it, understanding that she wasn't falling back on Strike because he's the only one that supported her, or as a rebound from something unhealthy. It has to be in the full knowledge of what their connection really means. Ryan doesn't have to be bad. He's just not Strike.
Nikki, you're a poet. I love it.
I don't think he has to be bad, but he might be. No, but I really like this comment because for the most part, I completely agree with Nikki. The one thing that I challenge in this is where she says that there's a temptation to call him Matthew 2.0, because that comes directly from the book with the countless comparisons and reminders of Matthew.
Of course, you could make the argument that all of those comparisons are Robin's history coloring her perspective and making her an unreliable narrator, which could be the case, even though I kind of think it is Matthew-like too.
My argument is not that behaving that way is bad or wanting the things that Matthew and Ryan might want are bad.
For their girlfriend to not be in love with another man.
Yeah, that, but it's bad for Robin. Yeah. It's not a good match. So
yeah.
Seeing that he is like Matthew doesn't make him a bad guy. Mm. I'm not even arguing that it makes Matthew a bad guy. I'm arguing it makes him a bad match for Robin.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we're wrong to point those comparisons out.
Okay.
But in general, I love this argument and I think it's an important one. We made the exact argument before the running grave, and I am still so caught up in this because I am so with Nikki about Robin needing to make the right choice because she's following her heart, mm-hmm. not because she's just encountered another bad guy and Strike is the only good option. That's not romance. That's not growth.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I really love that Nikki points out is that J.K. Rowling has done a fantastic job at making Strike and Robin work on themselves before they get together. The focus has always been so strongly on Strike, and I think so many people think the reason they aren't together yet is mostly his fault, but Robin has stuff going on there too. She seems so afraid of people knowing her real feelings. She goes mm-hmm. along with things just so she doesn't have to ruffle feathers. Mm-hmm. We've talked so much about Strike repeating his past mistakes and all of that finally coming to a head, but I think we're at Robin's turn for that now. I think that Robin is finally going to have to face some of her flaws and mistakes that she's made in the next book.
I absolutely agree. We've talked so much about Robin being a people pleaser, about being mm-hmm. passive in her personal life, about being so reserved and keeping her feelings secret. I think that you're right, and that book 8 is going to be where Robin finally takes all of the courage and determination that she's developed in her professional life and start applying it to her personal life as well,
yeah.
which is what yeah. she needs to do. She needs to take that boss babe energy and be a boss babe in the sheets as well as on the streets. Oh, metaphorically.
Yeah. Boss babe in the sheets. Wow.
And the streets.
You know what this makes me think of? I know Joe said something before about how Strike is so calm and rational when it comes to his professional life. But when it comes to mm-hmm. his personal life and relationships, he's a bit of an idiot.
Yeah.
In this book, especially, we start to see Strike start to sort of pull those two selves together into a more cohesive whole.
Yeah.
So I think that it absolutely follows that Robin is going to end up doing the exact same thing. And hopefully all of that in the next book. I've got my fingers crossed.
I really think so. I guess my overall feelings about Murphy right now are that I think there are good arguments for both sides. And we have no way of knowing which way it's going to go. Mm-hmm. I just keep mm-hmm. going back to your ideas, Pools, about there being a combination of both of these arguments where mm-hmm. she follows her heart and then we see a little bit of drama from him.
Yeah.
Because I still believe that Joe is setting the way for Robin to actively choose Strike because she's going to realize what real love is. She's going to either stop being so afraid or act despite being afraid.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't ignore some of the things we're potentially seeing from Murphy, particularly Wardle using the words mean and aggressive. So I'm a Murphy open-minder right now.
I'm basically holding both opinions in my head at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Murphy is simultaneously a complete asshole who's tracking her phone and about to go off the rails. And also a decent guy who's just not right for Robin and she needs to face that and let him go.
Yeah.
At the same time, he's Schrodinger's boyfriend, okay? He is both terrible and decent until the moment we crack book 8 open to observe him. That's what I'm feeling.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. We just don't know yet, but both options
mm-hmm.
have valid arguments, I think.
Yeah.
I'm open-minded about his general overall goodness,
mm-hmm.
but I still don't really like him.
Yeah.
It feels like anytime we say something good about him, we get the Murphy haters coming out strong. Anytime we say something bad about him, we get the Murphy defenders coming out strong. I just want everyone to take a deep breath and remember that he doesn't matter. That's my biggest takeaway from Murphy. He doesn't matter.
Poor Murphy.
Poor Murphy.
Sorry, man. We'll hook you up with Lorelai. You'll be happy there ever you go. After. It's yeah. great.
I don't know. Hopefully that covers it.
I think so.
Like I said, we're going to talk about the things that annoy us about him, but please don't take that as me saying that he's evil. I see a lot of things that make him not a good match for her, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's being set up that way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's jump into today's chapter. So we're starting with chapter 27.
In this chapter, Robin experiences her first dinner, I guess if you can call it that, at Chapman Farm, and Jonathan Wace speaks to the group.
So the epigraph reads, Thunder comes resounding out of the earth, the image of enthusiasm. Thus the ancient kings made music in order to honor merit and offered it with splendor to the supreme deity. And that's from hexagram 16, enthusiasm.
Okay, the image of enthusiasm is absolutely connecting to the mood of the first dinner where Wace is there and bringing people up for recognition.
Mm-hmm.
I think my cake deck has a really great interpretation for this chapter. It says, effective leaders do not seek to change opinion or change minds, but rather, they rouse popular sentiment into real action. Like rolling thunder, music can open a mystical gateway to emotions that draw people together with a united heart. The people then rise in enthusiasm for a cause, an undertaking, or even a war. Obviously, Wace is trying to shape opinion, but he's doing it by using things like music and festivity to unite people against a common enemy, and it's so effective. I honestly think that this is one of the most relatable ways of getting people in. Because if you've ever felt that kind of excitement from being around people with a shared love for something, a concert, conference, Comic-Con, you know, shared enthusiasm is powerful.
Yeah, I think you're so right. I don't have anything to add to that. I think, yeah, that's exactly what's going on here.
Okay, so at the start of the chapter, Penny is amazed by Mazu opening the door with her spirit powers. And Robin thinks it was unnervingly convincing, but wonders how it was actually done. I don't know if we ever find this out.
I'm more concerned about how gullible these people apparently are. How can Penny be amazed by this very obvious trick? Am I just a cynical asshole who's always looking for the man behind the curtain?
I would be too. Maybe there are more people thinking this and we just don't know. We're just seeing the teenager responding.
Yeah, just the teenage girl. But come on, Penny, wise up.
So they're again greeted by Becca, and this is where she tells them about the drowned prophet. The drowned prophet teaches us, firstly, that death may come to any of us at any time, so we should hold ourselves always in spiritual readiness to rejoin the spirit world. Which sounds like some culty bullshit if I ever heard of it, right?
Well, it also sounds like a pretty safe lesson to teach, because you're not really going to find many people disagreeing that death can come for anyone at any time.
Unless it's a teenage boy who fully believes that he's invincible. Like the stories of the stupid shit my brother did as a teenage boy into his 20s. But yeah, the thought that death comes for all of us anytime keeps me up at night.
Mm-hmm.
Afraid of dropping dead of a brain aneurysm in my sleep.
Oh, me too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Totally normal. We're totally normal fools.
I don't need therapy.
No. But yes to the teenage boy thing. My youngest brother, Matthew, and our neighbor Charlie, they used to jump off our roof into the bushes for fun.
How tall is the roof? Second story?
No, it was one story, but okay. Still. And then one time Charlie took a video of just running as fast as he could into a concrete wall and then posted it online. It actually got picked up by Jay Leno. And he talked about it on his show about how stupid it was and played the video.
So funny. One time my brother, and this was not a young teenager, he was in his 20s, his friend dropped him off in the car. And my brother, and this is the same brother that's reading Corman Strike right now, he decided it would be funny to prank his friend by jumping in front of the car and scaring him as he drove off.
Oh my God.
So he got hit by the car like a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
Banged his head back on the curb.
Oh my gosh.
Got up, wandered into the wrong apartment, started throwing up blood at some point, and then was like, maybe I should go to the ER and call mom.
Maybe.
And did. I don't know if it lowered his brain function in the end, but stupid shit.
His reading of Strike is spot on. Yes. So
his opinions of Strike. Yes. Are spot on. He gets it.
He does get it.
He must have survived brain intact. I don't know how any teenage boy makes it into adulthood.
I think that story beats mine.
Anyway.
All right. Next, Becca says, secondly, her self-sacrifice shows us the importance of obedience to the blessed divinity.
Okay. I have to bring up Deathly Hallows again. Mm-hmm. Because I'm seeing a reverse parallel here, because the UHC is pushing the story that Dayu went willingly to death as the self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that's not true. Unlike Harry, who did walk willingly to death to sacrifice himself, it's kind of like I was saying in the last episode, it's almost like this is the anti-Hogwarts. It's the anti-Hallows.
That is brilliant. I love that. And the difference in Harry versus Dayu's reason for sacrificing themselves, I mean, well, the stated reason in Dayu's case, is interesting too. For the UHC, the lesson here is obedience. But Harry didn't sacrifice himself because he was obeying Dumbledore. He did it because he realized this is what needed to happen to save the people he loved and the rest of the world, right?
Right. I guess, is Dayu the anti-hero? Don't do it. Don't sing it. Don't sing it.
You're asking a lot of me not to sing it. Seriously, though, that song kind of fits for Dayu.
I kind of want to keep my eye on this as we go.
Yeah, let's keep our eye on this.
So the last thing that Becca says is, thirdly, she proves the reality of life after death because she continues to move between the earthly and spiritual planes.
So this is the one that I think they really want to drive home because it's where the fear lies. They can get people believing that Dayu is really floating between earthly and spiritual planes. They can control them by fear, and they do.
Yep. It's their weapon.
And then here is where Becca invites them to kneel, place water from the fountain on their foreheads and say, the drowned prophet will bless all who worship her. I still think this is a big ask for day one, but really, I think it's a test.
For me, this is a way of creating a group identity into which the individuals are subsumed, because everyone in the group does this. To not do it would be to stand out, and people want to conform to the group, and they're all exhausted. They just want their dinner. But once they all do it, they're part of the club, and they can't think that it's silly anymore because they've done it. So that would make them silly. So they become more invested in agreeing with the action and the meaning behind it, and then thus with the larger narrative that the UHC is pushing onto them.
You're absolutely right. But I was also struck by the imagery of baptism here, water to the forehead. It feels to me like they're being asked to baptize themselves multiple times a day, where it's like they're forcing people to recommit themselves to the UHC over and over and over again. And the ceremony of the whole thing must play into their mindsets.
Oh, you know what? That makes sense. Much more sense than what I thought, which is that they were putting mind control chemicals into the fountain water that like seep in through the skin of the forehead. I'm kidding. I didn't actually think that, but that would be a great conspiracy theory.
Sure. I mean, it's not that out there because I was also thinking that something was going on with that. Yeah. For me, it was the carrots.
Yeah.
But anyway, water to the forehead feels very significant, and the ritual and ceremony of it, because it's another way in which water and baptism are major themes in the book, starting with the beginning with the baptism of baby Benjamin.
Yeah, I really love that idea that you brought up, Linz, of the members recommitting themselves over and over with the water to the forehead. That's really great. I love that.
At the beginning, they were renouncing Satan, and now she's worshiping the girl from the ring.
Basically the same thing.
Basically the imagery? Yeah, scary.
Water is a big theme in Troubled Blood as well. As we know, very important liquid, but it didn't have the theme of baptism. And personally, I think that connects to Strike, because if with baptism we are spiritually reborn and made new, so is Strike in this book, particularly in chapter 64, which just so happens to take place in a church named St. John the Baptist, not to be confused with St. John the Baptist. Those are different churches.
Oh my God. Are you ever going to get over that?
No, of course not.
You're going to be mad about that for the next 60 years?
Well, yeah. laughing more likely. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But I was actually talking to Beatrice Groves about this the other day because we were talking about her blog post that she's doing. And she mentioned that she actually wrote a recent blog about this very idea, and we can link to it in the show notes. You can go check it out. Ken, do you want to read some of what she wrote?
Yeah. So she says, I think it is a big focus with the opening scene and the use of baptism as a name for dedicating yourself to the UHC. The grief of losing Dobby is the alembic which purifies Harry's understanding, teaching him the true way forward. Strike's grief in this scene works in precisely the same way, and it is highly fitting that the scene takes place in a church dedicated to John the Baptist. John the Baptist is the prophet who tells people to prepare and purify themselves in readiness for what is to come. And this is what happens emotionally and psychologically to Strike in this church. In finally acknowledging Charlotte as the legacy of Leda, Strike makes straight the way to a new form of loving. He frees himself to seek stability rather than instability in a relationship, and, it seems likely, frees himself to consider the marriage and children he has been shunning likewise.
One of the things there, the grief of losing Dobby, that just makes me think of the line, and I had to pull it up from Deathly Hallows, where it says, because this is one of my favorite lines in the entire series, when it says, grief, it seemed, drove Voldemort out, though Dumbledore, of course, would have said that it was love.
Oh.
I just feel like if that is the moment for Harry, it kind of also connects to Strike for me when he is sort of grieving, but it's not really grief, it's love for Robin. Mm-hmm. We can explore that later, but it just made me think of that.
Dr. Groves continues, and then Aylmerton Church's dedication to John the Baptist also forms a nice ring connection with the Anglican Church that had appeared off stage at the opening of Running Grave. Although the moment of baptism itself only enters the narrative in the form of jokes, the recollection of Bijou's attention-seeking misbehavior as the holy water is poured strikes renunciation of Satan, we had a good run, it is a striking symbolism that the baptism of Strike and Robin's godchild opens the action of the novel, as well as, incidentally, informing us that Strike, like Harry, is baptized, as you cannot otherwise be a godparent. But in John the Baptist, Aylmerton, Strike experiences another baptism, a baptism of the spiritual imagination. So this is wonderful. I really love the comparison of Strike's experience at the church in chapter 64 to a baptism, because it really does feel like a renewal. He walked out of that church a different man than when he walked in.
Yeah, he found what he needed, didn't he? Oh, it's the best chapter.
It's the best chapter. So good. Robin then enters the dining hall. Heroes by David Bowie starts playing, and then Jonathan and Mazzy Wace enter.
Very observant of Robin to notice, isn't sitting at the head table, and at this point she isn't sure that he's related, but notices the similarity to Mazu and suspects he's another son. Do you think he's Wace's son or he's somebody else's son?
I think he must be Wace's. Who else would Mazu be sleeping with?
I just thought because he was kind of treated as more low.
I think he's like the younger son, and maybe he came out not what they wanted. I feel like he's Wace's son, but I don't have anything to back that up.
I kind of was getting the opposite vibe, but I don't have anything to back it up either, other than he's treated differently than Tayo.
Yeah, but there's favoritism with biological children, like, all the time.
Yeah, I was just hopeful that Robin was going to be able to manipulate this guy, and I was pleased to see that I was right about that, because there's always a crack in there somewhere. You know, he's the weak link.
That's funny that you call him the weak link because of Strike comparing him to the Piltdown Man.
All right, so there's this internal aside from Robin where it says Robin was once again struck by his striking good looks and how little he looked like a man in his mid-60s.
Didn't someone suggest Matthew McConaughey as Wace? He is about a decade younger than Wace, but I can see
it. 100%. I think I saw it on Twitter. For the life of me, I couldn't remember who said it, and I apologize, but if it was you, let me know. And now I can't picture anyone else playing Wace, because honest to God, if Matthew McConaughey could do a British accent, but he could absolutely nail Wace's like humble, charming, crocodile tear, sensitive, sociopath persona, right? Matthew McConaughey would totally pull that off. I can picture him preaching.
Yeah.
Like his character in Contact, but an asshole.
I mean, we could go down a rabbit hole with this, but one of my favorite things about getting a new adaptation is seeing who gets cast as each characters.
Yes.
It's a little too far ahead to start thinking about The Running Grave, but I'm really looking forward to The Ink Black Heart because they start filming next month.
Oh, that's exciting.
I know.
Are we gonna get behind the scenes stuff from our friends?
I hope so.
Nice.
If they start filming next month, I would think that fairly soon we'd start hearing some things. We should start keeping our eye out on places like Twitter, IMDb, or wherever.
Ooh, yeah. So this moment where Robin sees Will cheering and clapping along to the song, it says she found herself completely in sympathy with James Ensor, who'd called Will an idiot. This is, I think, the least understanding and empathetic that Robin is towards Will in this whole book. But of course, she hasn't yet gained a full understanding of just what this place does to a person. So she's seen all the silly bits of this cult, the ridiculous behavior they expect of people that people perform, but she hasn't yet fully experienced the coercion that makes people believe in these silly bits, that makes them go along with this stuff.
And it's understandable that she thinks this.
Yeah, because sometimes I'm like, well, you're an idiot.
We do see her a lot of times think to herself and wonder why no one else sees what she does.
Yeah.
The truth, though, is that they might. They've just been there long enough to be too afraid to express it.
They've been trained to wipe it out of their own heads, basically.
But it's a fair question.
I think it all the time, too. I'm like, oh my God, these fucking people. Are you kidding me with this?
You mean in real life, not just the cults in this fictional book?
Literally everywhere I go. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with these people?
Can we talk about how depressing the food is?
Oh my God. Yes. It's so sad. And what gets me is, okay, I understand underfeeding them with just like the empty carbs and the low-cal veggies. I get the starvation part of it. That makes sense. But why do they also have to cook it in such a disgusting way? Like, why too much turmeric and overcooked noodles? It's like, it's rubbing salt in the wound. It's gratuitously cruel. And I mean, if I had somehow managed to stick around until now, if I had managed to push through the orange tracksuits and gotten to this dinner, this is what would have made me get up and walk out. Because absolutely not. You're like,
I'm going for a burger. Who's with me?
I think I saw Popeyes down the road. We going? We getting some chicken? Let's go.
This is one of the only times in the book where I don't want to eat what they're eating.
Yeah.
I would gladly take the contents of Madeline's fridge over this meal.
Yes.
I can almost guarantee, not 100%, but almost, that Madeline doesn't have any body grown carrots.
No corpse carrots. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a definite 1-0 win for Madeline versus the UHC, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Robin's still ahead because she, first of all, has no corpse carrots, but also boobs. So that's 3-1-0. Robin takes the lead.
Wow.
Oh my God. We promised that we would keep these cult bits fun, and Pools is out here making it happen. Hashtag corpse carrots.
Corpse carrots.
Oh my God. Full of vitamins and horror.
The two guys that Robin is talking to during dinner, they just feel like total bros.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me is how they talk about a spiritual battle that's happening on Earth and we have to win. I think that the UHC has a lot of different ways of hooking people in, and it seems like for these two, this idea of being a part of some epic battle is appealing. I don't know if that's right, but it's the vibe I'm getting from them.
I feel like you're implying that these bros played a lot of video games.
That's exactly what I was saying without saying it.
That's what you're implying? Yeah, I feel like that might definitely be the case.
So there's this whole part where Jonathan Wei speaks again, and he brings up people who have earned his recognition this week. The show of emotion caused a level of hysteria in the hall that Robin started to find almost unnerving.
This line really set the scene for me because I feel like I can totally understand this kind of thing, kind of how I was talking about in the epigraph.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of being in the audience at a certain concert.
We know you got to go to the Eras tour, Lindsay. We know.
And just all the energy and excitement, because it hypes everyone up and brings everyone together. There really was the sense of camaraderie there that I have never felt at another concert before.
It was very special.
There is something magical about being in a space with that kind of energy and excitement, and it does make you all feel connected. And I think they're really smart to use things like music and this hype ceremony to create that feeling here.
Every single thing that this place does fits into the break someone down, rebuild them in our own image mold. It's like a dark alchemical process, kind of like a twisted alchemy.
Mm.
Which is going to be the name of my band.
Oh, mine is the Harpies.
The chapter ends with Waste leading a meditation. And this is the first time that we are introduced to the chant.
I feel like we should all say it together.
I feel like we're never going to be able to sync that up, and we'll spend 20 minutes trying. So maybe not so much.
Ready? 1, 2, 3. Loka
Samasta Sukhinu Bhavantu. See, you all talk too slow. God damn it.
Okay, faster. Loka Samasta. Where are you guys?
Countdown. We got to set up a beat. Loka Samasta Sukhinu Bhavantu. Like, right? Okay, so let's do that.
Ready? One, two, three.
Loka.
You're going too slow again.
Hell. Can someone keep time?
1, 2, 3. Loka
Samasta Sukhinu Bhavantu. That was close enough.
that was a disaster. Oh,
moving
my God.
On.
How did they get so many people to do that? We can't even get three of us.
Maybe we just really suck it.
I think that's it.
Well, I think it would be easier if we were in person. The internet connection doesn't help.
Yeah, that's the
lag. We'll blame that.
Moving on.
If you Google this, it means may everyone in the whole world be happy.
Hmm.
It's interesting that this is being introduced to us in this chapter where Robin is watching what seems like genuine happiness with the excitement and hysteria, the cheers, but it's not lasting happiness and it's not true happiness.
No, it's the veneer of happiness masking nightmares.
I know that we're in a Robin cult chapter, but the first person that I thought about when I read this translation is Strike and how he ends up choosing his own happiness.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe there's a parallel here with this facade of happiness that we see in this chapter at the UHC, but we know deep down no one there could be truly happy. And I think that's true with Strike in this book too. And it's not like he's putting on a face of happiness, because we know he doesn't do that well. Even Joe said so on Twitter. But he has been pretending to be happy with this life for so long, and now he's realizing that he's not.
He could be happier. He wants to actually be happy instead of just
pretending he doesn't need things.
Yeah. Oh.
How exciting is it going to be to read a strike that's finally decided to take his happiness into his own hands and like make his life for himself?
Remember when we thought that we'd get Flirty Strike in this book?
I do.
Feel like we're going to get Flirty Strike in book 8.
Oh, see, now God. I don't know if we are because...
I don't care. I'm going to predict it anyways. I want it.
I want it too.
You know.
When the time is right, we'll get Flirty Strike, I think.
Right.
Going off of what you just said, Kenz, I think one of the most exciting things for me with these later books is with each one, we know we're going to see the significant growth in each of them. Mm-hmm. And if I can quote Lethal White here, it makes the books feel both new and familiar each time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to chapter 28.
How many chapters till they sleep in bed together and hold hands? Can we get a countdown or?
Countdown at the end of each episode. We're X many.
X many chapters from the scene. Our listeners can probably calculate that for us and let us know.
Do math better than we can?
We're going to outsource that math.
I think that a blind gorilla could do math better than I can. Let's go to chapter 28.
All right. So in chapter 28, Strike interviews Abigail Glover.
And the epigraph, this hexagram is composed of the trigram li above, i.e. flame, which burns upward, and tui below, i.e. the lake, which seeps downward. And that's hexagram 38, opposition.
I love this epigraph. So first of all, here's that trigram tui the lake, which I was talking about earlier, by the way. The thing here is that if I had paid attention to this epigraph the first time around and gone into look into the Book of Changes, the I Ching, and figured out what it was talking about, I feel like I would have immediately known that Abigail killed Dayu, because Abigail is the flame above, literally a firefighter. Dayu is the lake below. And it says in the image of this hexagram, these two movements are in direct contrast. Furthermore, Li is the second daughter and Tui the youngest daughter. And although they live in the same house, they belong to different men. Hence, their wills are not the same, but are divergently directed. Dayu is the youngest daughter, but Abigail comes second. The sibling jealousy is pointed out right here. And if I had keyed into that and been like, oh, wait, the sibling jealousy parallel would have solved the whole thing. But so Dayu and Abigail, they belong to different mothers rather than different men. But actually, I think the father that Abigail had before Mazu was different than the father she had afterwards, or at least that's how she sees it. The two girls are in opposition in Abigail's mind. And I think that's the key point we should be taking away from this chapter. The key to the whole mystery, you guys.
I love this. And not just because it's interesting in general, but because I was genuinely hoping that the Abigail chapter epigraph would be a clue, because there are times where I think the epigraphs are pointing us to the killer, but we never pick up on it on a first read. And this one's even more hidden.
Yeah, because you got to go read it.
Yeah, you got to go look it up. Yeah. But looking at Silkworm, when Strike first interviews Tassel, the epigraph says, I took the book and so the old man vanished.
Oh my God.
I know.
Oh,
in Troubled Blood, there's a Janus chapter that says, I, me, she said, where am I or with whom, among the living or among the dead? This one isn't quite as on the nose as the Tassel one is, but once you realize Janus is living with all of the photos and obituaries of people she's killed, it feels more telling.
Yeah.
And she is also compared to Duessa, who is one of the villains in The Fairy Queen. I feel like there is another epigraph killer chapter that's very on the nose too, but I cannot remember what it is. I'll have to go through and look, but this is definitely one of them, I think.
So we're back with Strike, and the first part of this chapter is Strike and Lucy having a visit with Ted, where they see that he's clearly needing some sort of medical evaluation.
I noticed that Ted called Lucy Joan twice, so I am still going to hang on to that theory for a bit that he might meet Robin and call her Joan.
And reveal a clue. Yeah,
yes.
I am fully committed to that theory as well.
Thank you.
I love it. But this bit, it's sad, but I really loved the conversation between Strike and Lucy in this chapter, because they're working together here as a team to deal with Ted. And I feel like their dynamic has shifted since that pivotal moment in chapter 11. It's not like anything we've really seen before, except maybe when they were driving down in Troubled Blood. Strike is being helpful and present. Lucy is being reasonable. And, you know, not annoying. They're solving the problem together without driving each other crazy. And it's great.
Yeah, I agree. The Lucy bits, I've said before, some of my favorite bits. And I think part of that is because we are seeing a truly different and better version of Strike.
Yeah.
Seeing him behave differently with Lucy is maybe setting us up for him behaving differently when it comes to a different relationship.
Oh, 100%. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean.
I'm talking about Robin.
I'm picking up what you're... Oh, thank you for clarifying. You didn't need to. Maybe for Ken's. I don't know.
Oh,
damn.
Insulting.
Okay. So this line is interesting to me, where Strike thinks guilt, which wasn't entirely due to the fact that Lucy did considerably more looking after Ted than he did, prompted Strike to whatever. So this other thing that Strike is feeling guilty about goes unsaid, but we know that it's about what Lucy revealed to him in chapter 11, right? He feels guilty for not protecting her, for not knowing what happened. And that's the portion of guilt that's making him do this.
Oh, yeah.
Strike traveled back to Denmark Street that evening with the now familiar faint depression dogging him. Mm-hmm. Talking to Robin, even on work matters, tended to lift his mood, but that option wasn't open to him and might not be possible for weeks.
This is a long way around saying that he misses her already.
You know what? I feel like Strike really should have had the foresight to save some voicemails from her that he could sit and like moodily listen to over and over so he could hear her voice and feel his feelings.
Maybe he reads old texts.
Oh my God, I bet he does. Oh, sweet baby. Listen, do I just really want that scene to happen in the adaptation? Yes.
Oh, might.
I feel like that might be something they do in the adaptation.
I think that that's very likely.
I think there's pretty good odds because they've ramped up the chemistry.
That's a way to show that he's visual, missing her. Yeah,
missing exactly. her voice, listening to her old voicemails.
I think that,
producers, if you're listening, please.
They're not.
I am begging you. They might be. I want him sitting in his attic apartment, vaping moodily, listening over and over to old voicemails from Robin about stupid work shit.
Yeah.
I want it.
I think that's a great guess.
If that happens, I'm going to be so excited.
Okay. Who's ready to talk about this bijou exchange?
Yes. Oh, lovely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So she texts. So are you undercover somewhere you can't get texts? Or am I being ghosted?
Oh, girl. If you have to ask if you're being ghosted.
Oh, yeah.
That's just embarrassing. Uh-huh. I'm embarrassed.
Don't forget the ghost emoji and the sticking out tongue laughing emoji.
It's a nice touch.
Her emoji game continues to be strong.
It is. Yeah, she's good at it.
This bit made me laugh, though, when he says, if she had any pride, he thought, that would be the end of the matter. And I'm like, I think we all knew that Bijou does not, in fact, have any pride, and that this won't be the end of the matter at all.
Oh, yeah. Not a chance.
Very, very strange that he thinks that she has any pride after that first meeting when she's squeezing her boobs together at him.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Okay, so going from laughing at Bijou, are we ready to go laugh at ourselves?
Always.
Yes.
I'm always ready to laugh at myself because I'm ridiculous.
This is a big one, I think.
Let's go. Ken's, take it away.
All right. So it's time for Strike's interview with Abigail, and here's what it says. The Forester on Seaford Road was a large pub with an exterior featuring wooden columns, window baskets, and green tiled walls. Its sign showing a stump with an axe sticking out of it.
A sign with an axe in a stump.
Oh,
we
boy.
Literally said that we were going to pay attention to locations and what they could mean about the person they're interviewing. And did any of us see a sign with an axe in a tree and think about how we were just told a couple chapters ago that there is a mysterious axe in a tree and think maybe this is important, maybe this is a clue? I didn't.
Nope.
Did not register, but really, really should have.
Yeah, it's literally a sign. The sign is a sign.
You asked for a sign
and we missed
it. There it is.
Not just the sign, but also here's a big red flag for me. She was late.
It's the worst.
I should have known she was trouble.
I was also very worried when Abigail was described as being super attractive. Because I was just over here begging Strike to not make any more power emotional decisions. I'm like, oh my God, please don't sleep with her, Strike.
Please. Huge same. We could talk about that more when she calls him sexy later. Because
the terror that struck in my heart. I was like, no.
Don't do it.
She apologizes for being late and says that her friends call her the late Abigail Glover. I was trying to find something here because mm-hmm. that nickname kind of implies that she's dead, mm-hmm. but I actually don't have any good thoughts. So
I'm just here wondering if a childhood spent in a cult that doesn't allow clocks or calendars might contribute to the chronic lateness a bit.
You know what? That's no excuse for me.
No excuse. No, obviously not.
You have a clock now.
I mean, she just never learned how to use them, you know?
This would still annoy me.
Yeah, I know.
Be like, stop bringing up the cult.
It's not the cult. You have a calendar. You have a clock. Use it.
Okay, I have a weird question. Mm. I know it's weird, but here we go. Do British people use the word rear to describe someone's butt?
What?
Or does rear view just mean her whole back? Here, it's definitely used for butts. But when it says her rear view showed a lot of muscle, which made him reflect that his own daily exercises weren't having nearly such a dramatic effect. My first thought was that Strike is doing butt exercises. And I was like, well, we're going to need to talk about this.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, first of all, I think that any good exercise program is going to include squats. That works all of the muscles. And I bet he could do a modified version. We really need the details of Strike's exercise routine.
I think so,
too.
You
need to get granular with this, Joe. Really zoom in. So we get the whole picture. But to your question, when I read this, I read it as just the view of her back, like the back side of her body. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing because of the whole, like, Canada is a bit more Brit connected, the Commonwealth, yeah. That's the case there too. It didn't even occur to me that he could be talking about her butt, to be honest.
Yeah.
Same. Not at all.
That's what I first thought of, really? But I wasn't sure. I was like, it could be either way for me.
I didn't,
but
think yeah, it at all.
I considered it being her.
I did not. But now I'm thinking about it. Butts in general. I'm like Tina Belcher over here. Butts, 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 butts. You know?
I do know.
Yeah. Oh my God. You know?
It's a pop culture reference that you get. Amazing.
Yeah. Either way, we don't get to read about Strike exercising like we had hoped and dreamed for, but it's apparently happening.
That's exciting for me.
It is.
Maybe we'll get more details.
I would like for this to be a thing in book 8. Just mm-hmm. have him get as sexy as possible.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Please and thank you.
For, you know, literature.
Literary needs.
It's symbolic of inner growth. Moving on.
I think I've spotted a few parallels to Cuckoo's Calling.
Ooh.
In Cuckoo's Calling, when we first meet John Bristow, it says Bristow's knee began jiggling up and down.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember us talking about that as a clue. Mm. And here in the beginning of his interview with Abigail, it says, having secured her drink, Abigail returned to Strike's table, sat down opposite him, and took a large gulp of white wine. One of her knees was jogging up and down.
Oh, that's such a good catch.
Okay, so the next thing mm-hmm. is Abigail not wanting him to go back to her flat because of the other occupant. This reminds me of Bristow not wanting Strike to go to his mother's house. And ooh. Both killers are hiding evidence in these places.
That is a brilliant catch. Yeah.
The other thing, and maybe we did talk about this, I can't remember, but obviously these are both sort of sibling murders fueled by jealousies, even though they're both not blood related. Mm-hmm. The difference is that Bristow maintained that he loved his sister and referred to her as his sister. But we see a little later in this chapter that Abigail gets instantly angry when Strike calls Dayu her sister.
Oh, yeah. I have a feeling that a lot of what Abigail does, I mean, with that, a lot of the murder was about punishing Mazu, her yeah. stepmother. Not really about Dayu, but it was about Mazu. Whereas yeah. for Bristow, it was about keeping his adopted mother entirely to himself. And he was punishing his siblings for being loved more than he was.
Yeah.
There's some complicated webs of connection there.
And then lastly, money being a red herring for motive. So Bristow did want Lula's money, right? But I think jealousy was the primary motive.
Yeah.
Especially because John Bristow also killed Charlie as children out of jealousy. And now that I think of it, that is also another connection because both Bristow and Abigail have killed as children and then committed another murder later in life.
Oh, you're right. Mm-hmm. Wow. And the second murder was to protect themselves from being caught rather than out of wanting to gain.
Oh, you're talking about Rochelle.
Yeah, I'm talking about Rochelle.
Oh, I was thinking.
Oh, and Lula.
Yeah, Lula. Yeah.
But Bristow also killed Rochelle and Abigail killed Kevin.
Yeah.
I guess Bristow's one murder up
ahead.
On Abigail.
He's winning?
Is he? I guess. This is funny because talking about scorekeeping, Bristow made his murders look like suicides, but Abigail caused two people to actually attempt and or commit suicide. So really, they're kind of tied.
They are.
I don't know where I was going with that, but.
Well, what I was getting at with the money being a red herring is that is with the Graves family, because that's a big red herring in this book. Strike gets into that a little later on in the chapter with Abigail when he explains that Dai Yu was Alexander Graves' daughter and that she would have inherited a lot of money.
And, you know, we're meant to think that Philippa or someone killed Dai Yu because they didn't want her to get the house or whatever.
I want to compare this next bit with what Strike says in the confrontation chapter at the end, because Abigail talks about being a firefighter because she's an adrenaline junkie and mentions that she hates it when kids are involved because obviously that's horrible.
Mm-hmm. So what does he say in the confrontation chapter?
So here is what Strike says in chapter 133. Is that what the firefighter stuff was about? Trying to atone? Because I don't think you're completely conscience-free, are you? Not if you're still having nightmares about hacking Dai Yu to pieces so the pigs could eat her more easily. You told me you quote-unquote hate it when there's kids involved. I'll bet you do. I'll bet it brings back worse bloody memories than Pirates of the Caribbean.
It would be so cool if there were Strike fans out there who are criminal profilers, because a profile of all the killers would be amazing.
You know, I feel like I've watched enough Criminal Minds to do a profile.
We've talked a lot about what makes people who they are, the abuse they suffered, all of that. In regards to that, I would argue that Abigail is the most sympathetic of all the killers because of what she went through and because of her age at the time of the crime.
I actually do kind of agree. I was thinking before about this, and Abigail is really the only killer we see who actually feels remorse or guilt for what she's done.
Exactly.
I think so.
Having said that, she was a grown-ass adult when she killed Kevin to protect herself. So maybe not getting off the hook for that one.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of think Kevin's murder and her attempt to murder Strike and Robin are more about her panicking and trying to cover her own tracks. I'm not sure if she's like Janice, who kills for the thrill of it. But then again, you start thinking about those little moments where she likes to control people, and I don't really know where she lies.
Yeah, I do think that Kevin and her little attempts on Strike and Robin, those are very much practically motivated murders. You know, she's not killing because she gets a thrill, although I do kind of think she might have gotten a little bit of an adrenaline rush from doing it.
It's tough, though, because I think that this crime, Dai Yu's murder, is one of the most horrific crimes that's ever taken place in these books. So it is hard to place her. Is she this evil, horrific killer who likes to control people and force them to do her bidding? Kind of. But is she also an abused child repeating what she's been taught? Kind of.
Yeah.
I'm just realizing how much this book deals with generational trauma and is putting Strike up against Abigail, where you have one person rising above that, Strike, obviously, and then Abigail, the killer, who doesn't.
And then that bit later in the book where Robin points out that Abigail is Strike's type of person. Yeah, there's definitely connection drawn between them, right? But at their core, they reacted very differently to their childhood trauma. Strike dedicated himself to fixing trauma elsewhere, restoring order to the world, whereas Abigail, like Mazu, decided to inflict violence and trauma on others to regain control.
Exactly. And I think that's such a huge theme of the whole series when it comes to the choices that you make.
Yeah.
All goes back to Dumbledore saying it's not our abilities, but our choices that define who we are. I think that must be a really important thing to J.K. Rowling, because I think it's in both of them.
I think so, too.
Okay, so this is from the second post that Dr. Groves did for us. And she says, Abigail's strength and bravery seem very appealing when we first meet her. Her choice to take on that most heroic of jobs, a firefighter, on her escape from her abusive childhood, forms an obvious parallel to Strike's choice after freeing himself from the same location to become a detective. Abigail is carving a niche for herself in a male world, and many a reader will be rooting for Strike here as he squashes down the entitlement of a man who mistakes his own desire for Abigail as a right to control her actions.
Yes, this is such a perfect thought to bring in here, because all of these interactions, Abigail's with Strikes, Strikes with Baz or Barry, they are perfectly calculated to gain our sympathy, because we have had six full books of Joe, Ms. Rowling, exposing male violence and misogyny we are primed to hate Baz and to want to protect Abigail. Mm-hmm. So Abigail is complaining to Strike about Baz, the guy who came up to them and warned Strike about Abigail going through men like diarrhea, which is disgusting, by the way. Abigail says that her...
I can't believe you said the word.
I know, I'm amazed with myself. And Abigail says that her lodger, Patrick, told Baz things about her life at the UHC. Then Patrick gets drunk with him and blabs stuff about what I told him about the UHC. And now that Arsenal sees me, uses it to... It's my fault, she said angrily. I should have kept my mouth shut. When many are... And then she trails off. And at this point, I was genuinely ready to stab both Patrick and Baz to protect Abigail. I fell for this hook, line, and sinker. I was like, oh, this poor woman who has had this horrible traumatic past, and now these assholes are harassing her.
It's the whole Janice thing again.
Oh my God, it is.
But Abigail having a lot of men around her who will do her bidding is important later, because mm-hmm. that's really her MO, is having other people help her commit her crimes, that smart. It kind of seems like she inherited her father's arrogance that he can control everything around him and not get caught.
Well, yeah. And it's kind of her father's MO too, making other people commit crimes mm-hmm. for him, isn't it? She inherited a lot from her father.
Yeah. And then when she says it's her fault, I know that she means she shouldn't have said anything to Patrick, but mm-hmm. I don't know, having a killer in a book say it's my fault, it does feel like maybe a bit of a nudge. Maybe that's a stretch, but
a little bit. I feel like this whole chapter has been full of neon signs flashing at Abigail.
Yeah.
And classic, I picked up none of them.
Right.
So after Abigail trails off from that speech and gulps some wine, Strike thinks about spirit bonding and wondered for the first time how young girls were when they were expected to join in. First of all, this is a horrifying thought, because I'm pretty sure that it's when they move to the adult dorms at age 13.
Yeah.
But this is also some foreshadowing for one of the crimes that's taking place at Chapman Farm, which is the rape of underage girls and Will impregnating 14-year-old Lynn.
Yeah.
Not very pleasant.
You can say that about the cult. Yeah, not very pleasant.
It is not a pleasant place.
Okay, so let's go on to where Abigail talks about her mother's death. Now, remember, Abigail's mother also drowned at Cromer Beach, and Kevin wanted Abigail to say that her father, Jonathan Wace, killed her.
It's kind of fascinating to me how defensive Abigail is about Wace pre-UHC. Mm-hmm. She wants to believe that the UHC made him what he is and that he was this amazing husband and father before. She says, when Pirbright said dad killed her, it was like he was taking something. It's about the only good thing I've ever had to hold on to from before Chapman Farm, that they loved each other. And if I haven't got that, then it's all shit, you know? Yes, said Strike, who'd had to work so hard to hold on to the good in his memories of his own mother. I do.
Oh.
Right away, this is another thing pairing the two of them,
yes.
Right? And a similarity between Strike and Abigail, but night and day with how they deal with it.
Exactly.
I think that Abigail believing this helps her justify it all a little bit. If she can believe that it was only Mazu who made things change and made her dad become bad, then she might feel like hurting Mazu by killing Dayu is sort of a repayment for taking her person away.
Yeah. And I feel like that's absolutely how she felt. And then there's sort of this chicken egg situation with what you said, right? She could also have focused all of her anger on Mazu at the time to preserve her father's image in her mind. And then that focus on her anger led to the obsession that killed Dyke. For retribution, she has to believe that it was Mazu's fault. So she hates Mazu, so she kills Dayu. Or she hates Mazu, so she believes it's Mazu's fault, so she kills Dayu. It's like it's a whole circle, you know?
It would ruin the whole mythology of her own crime that she has told herself if she thinks that her dad is just a bad guy too.
You know what? That makes me think of a fantastic thing I saw on Discord today. Michelle D wrote that there were parallels between Charlotte and the UHC, because Charlotte had this mythology of her relationship with Strike. And when that was shattered, she killed herself. And in the same way, the UHC had a mythology about the drowned prophet. When that's shattered, the UHC comes crashing down. And now we have Abigail here with this mythology of her father that she cannot let be shattered for her because it'll destroy her whole conception of herself. It's about these narratives that we tell ourselves and how we build our lives around them. And you take those narratives away and everything comes crashing down, right?
Yeah.
You know what's funny is that Michelle is the same Michelle that was talking about Murphy earlier.
Oh. Is it?
Yes.
Oh, shit, huh?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Same lady.
Thanks, Michelle. Love your ideas. I would subscribe to your newsletter. Preach.
A little later on in the chapter, when she talks about this belief that Mazu had changed her father, it says, Strike chose not to respond to this comment. He knew, of course, that alchemical changes of personality were possible under a strong influence. Mm. Now, Strike is talking about Wace, but very interesting that Joe chose to say alchemical changes because of the emphasis of that in these books, and Strike himself has been going through it.
Oh, I love that. Does that make Robin the strong influence? But then Strike is also a strong influence on her alchemical changes. They're changing each other for the better.
I'm noticing on this read how much information Abigail is trying to get out of Strike. Mm. She asks Strike if he's read Kevin's book, obviously to find out if Strike is suspicious of her, because Kevin might have been. She mentions that she found out Kevin was dealing drugs, presumably to confirm if that's the story Strike has been told about his death too. Mm-hmm. She's also constantly pushing him to see if he's going to publicize what she's telling him or write his own book. She wants constant reassurance that he's not going to tell anyone anything.
I feel like she also goes on a lot of little tangents, talking about other stuff, stalling for time to think, in my opinion.
Going on tangents. Can't relate.
Tangents? I've never met her.
No, we don't do that.
No. So we also get one of the more important ideas in the book here. Because Abigail is the first one to mention that the UHC is like a cancer. And she says, it's like cancer. You've got to cut the whole thing out or you'll just be back where you started. Sometimes you get something worse. And this is another instance where the killer says something true, something that resonates with the reader. And it's lulling us into this sort of false sense of security where we think, oh, this person gets it. They're a good egg, you know?
A good egg. I'm hearing and seeing the bad egg detector from Willy Wonka.
Another fascinating thing that Abigail says here is it's a man's world and women like Mazu, they know where the power is and they play the game. They want to make sure the men are happy and then the men will let them have a bit of power themselves. But what Abigail is talking about here with it's a man's world and women play the game. They play this game not just for safety, but for power that they can use to control other people, to inflict pain for the pleasure it brings them, to become the monster that hurt them. I know that I need to think more about this, but Mazu's psychology and Abigail's psychology fascinate me in this book because they're so similar and they're so born in the trauma that was inflicted onto them by male sexual violence, but they turned into monsters because of it.
It's kind of sad how Abigail talks a little later about how Mazu could make people do things to mm-hmm. themselves, and she mentions that she wasn't surprised that Cherie had left because Mazu would have killed her or made her kill herself after mm-hmm. Dai's death. Because you've just made me think that
right?
Abigail, my bois, my harpy, you've become what you hate. You know, she killed Kevin and forced Cherie to kill herself.
Exactly. She's become the monster.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because that's what the UHC does. It makes you an agent of infection. It makes you complicit. But both Abigail and Mazu went above and beyond complicity to mm-hmm. actively choosing to perpetuate and inflict this on other people for their own gratification, which is where you lose my sympathy.
Right.
And you get locked up.
This part is interesting to me when Abigail talks about how even though Dayu annoyed her and was spoiled, she did mm-hmm. care about her death and felt sad. And then she mentions that she can't watch Pirates of the Caribbean because the sea upsets her. I bet the sea actually does upset her mm-hmm. because of her mother's death. But it's kind of funny that she says this about Dayu's death, knowing full well that she didn't drown. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if she was really upset that she died, even though she did it, or if that upset was guilt or fear of getting caught. Well, maybe it is possible that she wanted her dead and then still felt sad about it.
Yeah, she wanted her dead, but she didn't realize what that would truly entail on her emotional center, what it would feel like. She didn't understand what that would be. Yeah.
Also, I wouldn't be me if I didn't give a little nod to Pirates, because yes, Abigail's talking about the movie. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know, the movie is based on The Ride at Disneyland, which opened mm-hmm. in 67.
Wow.
Is one of the best, most classic rides.
Mm-hmm. Is that for real? Because, like, I had no idea that that was based off of a ride.
Yeah, of course.
What? Kenzie, you're being sarcastic.
No, I'm not.
You're not being sarcastic?
No, seriously.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. There's even direct references in the movie that you'll only get if you know the ride. Like the prisoners dangling the keys to the dog.
Kenz, I've literally never been to any Disney property. And I still knew this shit about the ride. And I saw, oh, they're doing the thing that's in the ride on the ride. Movie.
Yeah.
Hang on, I've just figured this out. How old were you when Pirates of the Caribbean came out?
I was 10.
Oh my God. So that checks out. You were a baby, so you didn't know. And it's always just been a movie franchise to you.
Yes, correct.
Well, we've solved the mystery. And once again, it's leading to an existential crisis on Pools's End.
Anyway, I did Google this to see if they use the Pepper Ghost illusion in Pirates. I don't know about the one here, mm-hmm. but it does say that in the Shanghai Disneyland, they do use that.
Oh.
So, loving another reference to a Disneyland ride and those illusions. Mm-hmm. It's great fun for me. Okay. Here's another part where I feel like I should have been more suspicious of Abigail than I was, when it says that she was more unnerved than impressed when Strike told her that he knew Cherie had driven by her on the way to the beach. Mm-hmm. Anyone being unnerved by something that doesn't really seem that incriminating should have been a red flag.
It really should have been.
Now, this is also followed by Strike telling Abigail that Robin had interviewed Sheila Kennett. And I have to imagine that the news that Sheila was still alive was probably not great news for Abigail.
Sheila was the only one who knew Abigail, so she could probably have some stories to tell.
Sheila painted her, though, as like the little mm-hmm. girl.
Yeah.
But Abigail could have been still worried.
Yeah.
And I had wanted to talk about this thing with Abigail again, about why she does this whole thing about not having an education. And we see this happen quite a bit in this chapter, where she's trying to think of words, but she isn't really sure of the words mm-hmm. to use. I don't know if this is the truth or if she's playing it up for sympathy, like she wants Strike to think she's not very clever.
Yeah, I was wondering that as well.
My instinctual response is that this was probably truthful. We know the quality of education that happens on the farm and that it's not great. If Abigail wasn't naturally gifted or intellectual, I could absolutely see her not being able to think of the words. Mm-hmm. But it's a startling contrast to Kevin, who is in the cult from a much younger age and for much longer, but he still managed to write so eloquently.
Yeah, I think that's where it's coming from for me, is the contrast to Kevin.
Is it a natural difference, or is she playing this up for sympathy? I don't know.
It could be either. It probably doesn't matter that much in the end, but it's just interesting. There's that part earlier where she mentions maybe taking a class to get more educated, and Strike says it's never too late.
You know what's also never too late, Strike? Mm. The time to tell your partner that you're in love with her. Just to bring that up.
All right, when they start to talk about other things that Kevin alleged in his emails to Sir Colin, we get, I think, real setup for the actual crime. Mm-hmm. So Kevin mentions being drugged, and we know that happened that night, right?
Yes.
Kevin also claimed that Dayu can turn invisible, and Abigail laughs this off. Did she know that Cherie had come up with this story after the fact?
I don't think that she would have known this, because she was shipped off to Birmingham before the whole Drowned Prophet thing got going.
And then the pigs are mentioned, and this is a big one. Yeah. There's a lot of distraction around the pigs, where we don't really know what the cause of the fear is, mm-hmm. although we know now that it's none of the things that they talk about.
I think we always had an inkling.
It says, Sheila Kennett says Paul Draper got beaten for letting some escape, and Jordan Reaney's wife says he used to have nightmares about pigs. Mm-hmm. Abigail says that this wouldn't have been why they had nightmares. She blames this on Hexagram 29, the Abysmal, and explains that the I Ching was Mazu's way of deciding punishments. And since 29 mentions pigs, if she got that one, it says, you as a filthy liar, you as a pig, and Mazu made you crawl around on all fours until she said it was time to get up. Here's where Abigail messes up, though, because she tells Strike that the four of them were punished after Dai Yu's death and made to crawl around like pigs and wear pig masks. But the pig masks never existed outside of Abigail's control and her sex games.
It's bugging me that we never discover what the punishment that Mazu inflicted on them actually was. Sheila said that Brian wasn't the same afterwards. Was there a grain of truth in Abigail's story, or did she make it up completely? Like, was the punishment crawling around naked, or was it actually a beating or a whipping or being locked in the box?
I read this as that they did have to crawl around naked just mm-hmm. without the masks. Mm-hmm. It was the pig mask that Strike said no one ever mentioned the pig mask.
Okay, that makes sense. Because later, she does have Emily stand with the filthy pig sign, right? So the pigs are a thing, just not the masks.
Yeah, I think that this was truthful, just not the masks. In chapter 133, Strike says, "It was pretty stupid of you to tell me Mazu made people wear masks while crawling around on the ground. Obviously, I understand where you got the idea and that you were trying to add a knight's flourish to your depiction of her as a sociopath, but nobody else has mentioned the pig masks used in the context of punishment. It's important not to use incriminating things in their wrong context, even in the service of a cover story. Many a liar slips up that way. Signposts to things you might not want looked at."
She's just not as good a liar as Janice. Janice still holds the top crown.
She does. I wonder how Janice is doing.
Oh, prison.
Maybe Abigail and Janice end up in the same prison and they're both like that Cormoran Strike.
I think there's only like one women's prison. There's very few because there aren't that many women prisoners.
Do you think that Janice and Abigail are now teaming up?
And Tassel?
Oh, yeah, her too.
And did Kinvara end up going to prison as an accessory?
Maybe. She probably won't be there as long.
Women caught by Cormoran Strike support group. I'd love that. They can start like a knitting circle or something.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Oh, great.
We're pretty much at the end of the chapter. Abigail's pretty drunk by now and seemingly traumatized. Same. Maybe she is.
I mean,
I bet it isn't pleasant to have to think about a horrific murder you committed and try to make sure you're covering it up properly when talking to a famous detective. And of course, even Strike thinks that she does feel bad or have a guilty conscience later, so.
The guilty conscience thing. I'm wondering if you've ever read the book, The Body Keeps the Score. It's about trauma. There's one part that stuck with me when the author was talking about military veterans with PTSD, and often their PTSD was caused not by what was done to them or what they saw, but mostly by the atrocities that they themselves committed. That was the trauma that lingered. And the author writes, "It's hard enough to face the suffering that has been inflicted by others. But deep down, many traumatized people are even more haunted by the shame they feel about what they themselves did or did not do under the circumstances. They despise themselves for how terrified, dependent, excited, or enraged they felt."
Interesting.
I have a lot of issues with this book, but I feel like this point about the trauma that lingers being what you did, that's pretty spot on in regards to understanding what's going on with Abigail, because she does feel that shame.
I think so. It is also really making me curious about why Strike got his medal, because if there's any other comparison between these two, I think that might be one of them.
If the medal he doesn't talk about because it's about something he did that's...
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. You just blew my brain wide open. And now I feel like I need to know the story of how he got his medal.
I know.
And if it involved like something he feels deeply ashamed about.
Yeah.
So we have to talk about the end when they're outside and she tells Strike that he's kind of sexy.
As we already talked about, this made me a little nervous because Strike had already acknowledged how good looking she was and she's clearly not opposed.
Yeah.
But it was only a little bit really, because I really didn't believe that he would go there with a drunk, traumatized witness/suspect. Mm-hmm. But when she told him he was kind of sexy, I remember thinking, you leave him alone. I was ready to get out the spray bottle. Like, no.
Amazing. Yes. I was in the exact same place. I was like, absolutely not. Strike has done enough dumb shit for one novel. You go away.
Yeah, I felt
really
it too.
I was really grateful that didn't happen.
But here's a question, though. Do you think she found him more or less sexy when he confronts her in the end?
Listen, I gotta say, if I was a murderer, okay, and Strike caught me, and he did his whole monologue thing about how I fucked up and how he figured it out, I would find it very sexy. And I'd be like, okay, so you're gonna cuff me now, Cormoran? You're gonna... slap on the cuffs?
I don't know if he has any of those. He should get some, though.
I thought he stole some.
Oh, you're right.
Didn't he steal some?
Maybe that should come up later. I don't know.
I hope so. fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think she was bitterly disappointed when it was Murphy instead.
Aren't we all bitterly disappointed?
We're all bitterly disappointed with that.
We are. Literally, our bitter disappointment of the novel that is Murphy instead. Gets.
That's too true.
Great ending note.
Yeah. But before we go, we should say Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah.
Anyone want to throw out a 2024 prediction?
They kiss.
I meant that we're going to get book 8.
Oh, okay. Well, I was taking that for a given.
I'm predicting book 8.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that's a safe prediction.
We're manifesting it.
In 2024, we go pure spirit and we make the magic happen.
All right. What are we doing in our next episode? Which, again, January 4th.
Okay. So in our next episode, we are doing chapters 29 through 32. And in these chapters, Robin meets Lynn and Dr. Zhao. And then Strike confronts Little John about working for Patterson in the past.
Ooh, those are fun.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, Strike confronting Little John is fun. The rest is
decidedly not fun.
But we're going to make it fun.
We are going to make it fun.
Strike and Ellicott Files.
Oh, yeah.
Making cults fun since 2023, as Ken said.
Oh, yeah.
Nailed it.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.